Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday was a momentous day in the U.S. as frontline healthcare workers received the first COVID vaccines. Almost 3 million vaccines are being distributed in the U.S. this week. Another 3 million are on standby for recipients to get a second one 3 weeks from now. Healthcare workers on the front lines and those in long-term care and assisted living facilities are first priority. FDA approval for the Moderna vaccine is expected this Friday. Vaccines from AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are in phase three clinical trials. Officials say if all goes according to plan, at least 100 million shots could be administered by next spring. Sarah Lindsay, an ICU nurse in Queens, was the first person in the U.S. to receive Pfizer's vaccine. And here is what she said after receiving the shot.
I would like to thank all the frontline workers, all my colleagues who've been doing a yeoman's job to fight this pandemic all over the world. I am hopeful, I feel hopeful today, relieved. I feel like healing is coming. I hope this marks the beginning to the end of a very painful time in our history. I want to instill public confidence that the vaccine is safe. We're in a pandemic, and so we all need to do our parts to put an end to the pandemic and to not give up so soon. There's light at the end of the tunnel, but we still need to continue to wear our masks, to social distance. I believe in science.
That was Sandra Lindsay, an ICU nurse in Queens, who received the first U.S. vaccine yesterday. We still don't know if a person who has been vaccinated can still get the virus and spread it. So masks and physical distancing are incredibly important, and we'll talk about that on today's show. Yesterday was also a somber day as this country hit the 300,000 mark. Over 300,000 people in the United States have lost their lives to COVID. More than 16.4 million people in the U.S. have contracted the virus. Public health officials say the next few months will be very, very difficult as cases and deaths continue to break records. In fact, some public health officials say that we can expect over 3,000 deaths every single day. Questions still remain about how many people will actually take the vaccine. According to a recent survey from the Pew Research Center, 60% of U.S. adults say they will get vaccinated. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey published in October found that about half of Black adults say they will not get vaccinated. And this morning on NPR, they also had a piece about Latinos who will be hesitant to take the vaccine. So what will it take to increase public confidence and be transparent along the way about things like allergic reactions or if something does happen to someone who takes the vaccine? Later in the show, we'll talk about vaccine equity in poor countries. About 67 could be forced to wait until at least 2022 because wealthy countries are hoarding so much supply. We're actually having a hard time reaching our guest. So while Kevin in our studio tries to get Paul off it, well, I would give out the phone number, but I really need a doctor on the line to answer your questions. So why don't I just give you a little bit of information from the New York Times? We got a lot of our research from the New York Times. And then actually, Leah, if you can text me and let me know when our guest arrived. I'm working on one screen today. We are all working in different places, and so we're all just kind of juggling things. So Leah, if you can hear this, please text me when our guest arrives because I only have one screen. So I'm just going to read from the New York Times. The first shots were given in the U.S. mass vaccination campaign on Monday, opening a new chapter in the battle against the pandemic, which has killed, as I said, more than 300,000 people. It has taken a particularly devastating toll on people of color. And I did actually listen to some news over the weekend, and a number of doctors are saying that they are going to do specific outreach in communities of color with doctors and nurses of color to talk to communities and let them know that this vaccine is safe. And so this is also a really important angle, because a lot of people just do not trust the health system for many, many very good reasons. The New York Times piece goes on to say that the first dose was administered in New York, and a lot of people were crying. I mean, frontline workers have really gone through so much over the past year. And then it was distributed across the country. UPS had videos over the weekend with trucks sending out the vaccine. And then, of course, airlines are sending out the vaccine. This is a massive, massive undertaking to all 50 states. And what we're hearing right now is that frontline workers, this includes janitors, it includes all kinds of doctors and nurses. In some cases, they're actually doing lotteries because they just don't have enough vaccines to give everyone in the hospital. And so it's interesting to see how all of this is playing out. And then we just found a piece over at CBS about how the vaccine might be delayed for older people in long-term facilities. CBS News obtained some documents produced by the Department of Health and Human Services with guidance for CVS and Walgreens. These are the pharmacy partners that are charged with carrying out the vaccine of residents at long-term care facilities. And HHS is instructing providers that the earliest the program can turn on is December 21st, and they're referencing the Pfizer vaccine. The rate of infection at nursing homes has been spiking in recent weeks. There have been so many cases and so many deaths, sadly, in nursing homes. On Face the Nation, HHS Secretary Alex Azar said that there would not be any delays for long-term care facilities, but CBS obtained these documents saying that it's going to be in December 21st will be the rollout. And I believe that do we have Paul Offit yet?
I'm here.
Oh, Paul, great. Thank you for joining us. Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit co-invented the rotavirus vaccine and is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. He says there is clear evidence that the vaccine is highly effective. Well, Dr. Offit, thank you so much for all of your work on this. It has been such a long and very difficult year. And as I said in the intro, yesterday was a very momentous day. It was incredible to watch nurses and doctors get the vaccine, but it was also a somber day because this country hit the 300,000 mark. How are you thinking about all of this?
Right. It's you wish we had 300 million doses right now. Because what's going to happen over the next few months is we'll make millions and then tens of millions of doses. And eventually over the next 4 or 5 or 6 months, we'll be able to inoculate those sort of first three groups that we've talked about, which encompasses about 150 million people before we even get to the general population. So there are going to be people who will suffer and be hospitalized and die from this disease because we can't get the vaccine out to everybody all at once. I think that to me is the most painful part. It's like, it's hard enough waiting to be saved, but you know, now in the process of getting saved, there's going to be people who are going to suffer this.
Right. And also, Dr. Offit, it's so important to point out that we still don't know if a person who's been vaccinated can get the virus and spread it, right? So masks and distancing are still incredibly important.
That's right. Although we should know by early next year. I was on an NIH call the other day, and there is a study that is being planned on college campuses to answer that question. In other words, we know that these two vaccines can protect you from disease. The question is, can they protect you from infection where you don't have symptoms, but you still can be contagious? We should know that early next year.
Early next year. Okay, that's great. So how do you see this playing out, Dr. Offit? Because if someone's walking around without a mask, I'm sure everyone's going to take a double take. There's still requirements for restaurants and stores. I mean, how do you see that all playing out just from a social perspective?
Well, now the good news is, I think we're going to have federal leadership that's going to make it very clear that masking is something that you should do as a patriot, as a member of this society. It's not just, you're just not protecting yourself, you're protecting other people. I think we're a country that's founded on the basis of individual rights and freedoms, including freedoms that we don't have. I mean, it is not your freedom to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection any more than it's your freedom to run a stop sign. So I think people need to embrace that. Hopefully we will eventually embrace that. I know we have it in us in this country to act as a society, seeing a foreign invader, in this case, the foreign invader, is this SARS-CoV-2 virus. I mean, we did it in World War II. I think we had this feeling with 9/11. I don't see why we can't, again, have this feeling for this virus.
Well, I want to give out the phone number. If any of you have questions for Dr. Offit about this vaccine, if you have concerns, if you'd like to talk with him about how these vaccines were approved, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Offit, you are a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. Tell us exactly how the Pfizer vaccine, since it's being administered, how that works.
Okay, so normally when you give a vaccine, you sort of take the virus and inactivate it, or you take the virus and weaken it, or you take one part of the virus. That's how you do it. That's not the way this is being done. Here, what happens is you know the protein of the virus you're interested in. It's that so-called spike protein that emanates from the surface of the virus. That's the protein that attaches the virus to cells. So if you can make antibodies that prevent the virus from attaching to cells, then you can prevent the virus from infecting cells, or said another way, infecting you. But instead of giving the protein, as we say do for the hepatitis B vaccine or the human papillomavirus vaccine, where you give a single purified protein, or flu block, which is a flu vaccine, here what you do is you give the small gene, so-called messenger RNA. It's in a little lipid capsule, a so-called nanoparticle, which is then taken up into the cytoplasm of your cells outside of the nucleus. And it then that little piece of messenger RNA is translated to the protein. So basically, your cells make the coronavirus spike protein. And then that protein is put on the surface of cells, and then that stimulates an immune response against that protein. So you make the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, then you make antibodies to the spike protein.
There's a really great video I found online about how vaccines actually work, what happens to the body once you get the shot. And it really, Dr. Offit, it just makes you realize how amazing the body really is.
It is. I mean, we've survived ever since we crawled out of ocean onto land. The main reason we can survive is that we are able to make an adaptive immune response. I think the public relation team that I would like to hire is Mother Nature's public relation team, because she has been trying to kill us ever since we crawled out of ocean onto land with bacteria, with viruses, with parasites, with fungi, and we fight back.
That's a very interesting way to look at it. Well, what are some of the other questions that you are hoping to answer, Dr. Offit? We talked about the fact that we will learn early next year if a person who's vaccinated can still get the virus and spread it. What about immunization? How long will immunization last, or when will we be able to answer that question?
Right. That's an important question. I think what we're only going to know that after these vaccines are out there. We're not going to know it before they're approved. We know that the Pfizer vaccine could protect you up to 3 months after your first dose. That's what we know. We know that the Moderna vaccine appears to be able to protect you for at least a couple months after your first dose. But does it protect you for 6 months? Does it protect you for a year? We don't know that. Mm-hmm. That said, I think when you have 95% effectiveness efficacy at 2 or 3 months, you can take a pretty good guess that it's going to be fairly highly effective 6 months or a year later. And more importantly, it looks like these vaccines can induce something called memory immune responses. So these are cells, so-called B cells which make antibodies, or T cells which help B cells make antibodies. If you have memory cells, so those are long-lived. Memory cells are long-lived. And as long as you have a virus like this one, which has an incubation period of about 6 days, meaning from the time when you're first exposed to when you develop symptoms, that's plenty of time, actually, for those memory cells to differentiate and become, for example, antibody-secreting cells. So I think that's actually the best news, that this is probably going to be a relatively longer-lived response, meaning years, not decades. Decades, but not just months.
What are some other questions you're hoping we'll get answers to in the next 6 months, for example?
Well, I guess the questions I'm interested in asking when we meet on Thursday with the representatives from Moderna is what you learn a lot from actually are the people who aren't protected that got a vaccine, the so-called breakthrough cases. So there were 11 people who got the vaccine and despite getting the vaccine, still got sick. What was it about those people that made it so that they weren't protected? Did they not develop an adequate immune response? Or said another way, is there a clear immunological correlate for protection? Were they of a certain, you know, racial or ethnic background? Did they have certain comorbidities, medical conditions? What was it about them that caused them not to be protected? That's usually where you get your most information.
What are the main differences between these different vaccines? Because Moderna's is expected to be approved this Friday, and then you've got AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson in phase 3 clinical trials.
Right. So the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccines are very similar. They're both the same platform, messenger RNA, that little piece of genetic material that codes for the protein. And it's just the messenger RNA that goes in the cell. The way the other two strategies work, both AstraZeneca's and Johnson & Johnson/Janssen, is that those are so-called replication defective viral vectors. And in the case of AstraZeneca, it's a so-called simian adenovirus. In the case of Johnson & Johnson, it's a human adenovirus type 26. So adenoviruses can cause disease. Adenoviruses can infect a variety of organs and cause disease. But these are replication defective adenoviruses. So they cannot reproduce themselves. Therefore, they cannot cause disease. What they do, however, is they can carry that gene, again, the gene that codes for the coronavirus spike protein, into cells and then cause the cell again to make that spike protein. So you then make antibodies. So it's kind of like a Trojan horse virus. It brings the gene that you want into the cells, but the virus can't reproduce itself and cause disease.
What would you say to people who are concerned about side effects from the vaccine? And how do you think the media should report on side effects and be transparent along the way?
Right. So I guess, again, looking for a better public relations team here in the case of your immune response. I mean, when you develop an immune response, either because you're being infected with a natural virus or because you're making an immune response to a vaccine, you have certain side effects. So your body makes proteins that have names like cytokines that can cause symptoms like fever, low-grade fever, headache, muscle ache, chills, joint pain, et cetera. With this vaccine, both these vaccines, both Pfizer and Moderna, it's pretty significant. If you're for the second dose, if you're less than 65 years of age, then you could have, you know, as many as 50% of people can have fever, including low-grade fever, headaches, chills, muscle aches, joint aches, enough so that you could actually miss a day of work, which is why, at least in our hospital, we are going to stagger immunizations, for example, to our emergency department staff. We're not giving everybody a vaccine on the same day. But people need to know that. They need to know that you can have side effects. And in the lymph node, actually, you know, underneath your the gland underneath your arm and the arm that got inoculated, that can swell up too. That's all just your immune response revving up to make it, you know, to protect you against the disease. So those are effects of vaccination. You also want to make sure you don't have an adverse effect, meaning a rare serious problem. Now, right now, you know that the vaccine's been given to tens of thousands of people. There doesn't appear to be a rare serious problem, but there might be, and it's because 10,000 people is not not a million people or 10 million people. We will know that soon because, remember, the first tier of people that get this vaccine are people who live and work in long-term care facilities and healthcare workers, mostly nurses, actually. Nurses comprise the most of the healthcare workers that are about to get this vaccine. You are going to know pretty soon what the if there is a rare side effect, serious side effect associated with getting that vaccine, because it's going to be in more than 20 million people.
The share of people in the U.S. who say that they will get the vaccine as soon as it's available has doubled since September, according to Axios. Dr. Offit, do you expect that number will go up as we're seeing more videos and more stories of people who are receiving the vaccine?
Yes, I do. I mean, if you look at that in September, when people were asked the question, would you get a COVID-19 vaccine? The question they were really being asked was, would you get a theoretical vaccine? Because there was no vaccine. I mean, now we know the vaccine. We know it has certain characteristics. It's 95% effective at protecting against disease, including severe disease, including people over 65 years of age, including people across a variety of sort of racial and ethnic backgrounds. That you know. And you know it appears to be safe, at least when it's in tens of thousands of people. So now you know a lot about these vaccines. Plus, you know a lot, millions of people are about to get it. before we get to the general population, tens of millions before we get to the general population. So I think you're going to have a lot of experience with this vaccine. And I think that number is just going to go up and up. Also, usually when people are sort of pushed back against vaccines, it's because they're mandated. This is not going to be a mandated vaccine because we don't have enough. It's frankly, it's a little more like the Beanie Baby phenomenon. I think it's going to be coveted because it's not terribly available initially. I mean, I can't wait to get this vaccine, and I am not first in line in our hospital. I'm going to have to wait till others get it in our hospital before I get it.
There have been over 16.5 million cases of COVID in the United States. That is a huge number. Should people who have recovered from COVID also get vaccinated?
Yes, that's the recommendation. And the Pfizer trial did not exclude people who had already been naturally infected. So now you have a large, again, safety database, knowing that even if you've had natural infection, you still can get this vaccine. I mean, some people who were naturally infected, say, asymptomatically, meaning never had symptoms, they may not have as robust of an immune response as someone who was more severely infected. So all that getting vaccinated will do if you've already been infected is just boost your immunity and make you even less likely of getting a second infection and probably prolong your immunity. So, yeah, people are still recommended to receive the vaccine. Also, programmatically, it would be very difficult to screen everybody to see who's been infected and who hasn't, and then only vaccinate those who've been infected, who have not been infected.
Experts say that it's still possible to get reinfected if you've already been infected, but it's very, very rare, right?
Ready? That's right. And usually when you get, and this is true of many viruses, influenza, rotavirus, et cetera, you often could get reinfected, but usually your second infection is not nearly as severe as the first. So natural infection tends to protect people against moderate to severe disease associated with reinfection.
Today, we are talking about the COVID vaccine with Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. He says there is clear evidence that the Pfizer vaccine is highly effective. And let's take a caller before break. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I take issue respectfully with the doctor's assertion that, quote-unquote, Mother Nature is trying to kill us. It's actually the other way around. We're the ones that have been killing Mother Nature and killing ourselves in the meantime. Case in point, this particular virus, I believe, transferred itself to humans through the encroachment in natural habitats, the bats and the animals. The other issue that I want to point out is, as an employee, as a healthcare employee, and I've been doing remote work lately, I also take serious issue about the direction that our country is going in, wherein we would be actually required to get a vaccination by our employers. Because to tell you the truth, if you're following the rules like most reasonable people, using masks and distancing and all the other things, you don't get it.
That's actually not true, Lisa. I've had friends.
Okay, well,
I lost a distant cousin who died from COVID, who was, quote, following all the rules. That's just not true. Dr. Offit, a lot of people who are following the rules are still getting COVID.
No, definitely. You know, it's not the masks obviously are imperfect, even if they're 3-ply and put properly over nose and mouth. You still can breathe through the sides. I mean, it's not, for example, an N95 respirator mask is a much better mask than a typical mask. So that's true. I don't think this vaccine is going to be mandated. I mean, we do mandate, for example, the influenza vaccine in our hospital, because we think that if you are going to be around a vulnerable population of hospitalized children, many of whom can't be vaccinated because they're getting, you know, chemotherapy or whatever, it is your responsibility to be vaccinated. You know, it's not your right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection. And regarding Mother Nature, just in terms of encroaching on the animal kingdom, you know, many of the viruses and bacteria that we have were originally animal viruses or animal bacteria. I mean, tuberculosis was ultimately originally an animal virus. I mean, or animal bacteria. You know, influenza is a bird virus. Human immunodeficiency virus was originally sort of mutated from simian immunodeficiency virus in monkeys in the 1930s in Cameroon. So, I mean, it's just, this is because we live in close association with animals. There's just no avoiding that, really.
Right. Well, Lisa, again, sorry to cut you off like that, but we have to share factual information. vaccination. And we know that so many people are being irresponsible by not wearing masks, going to events with a lot of people. But a lot of people who are being responsible are still getting the virus. And that is really important to point out. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I just wanted to ask two questions. One is, you may not be able to get 100% of the population to get the vaccine, so I don't know what kind of a problem going forward that would pose. Secondly, this is not going to be the last kind of virus or problem, public health problem, we're going to face or the rest of the world's going to face. What do you suggest people do going forward in order for us to protect ourselves and the rest of the population from what's going to be coming?
Right. Great questions. I think in terms of the percentage of the population that you would need to vaccinate to stop the spread of this virus, it's not as contagious as measles. And we were able to eliminate measles from the United States by the year 2000. The only reason measles came back is because a critical number of parents chose not to vaccinate their children. And so it came back. It's the most contagious of the vaccine preventable diseases. The fact that we could eliminate measles tells you we can eliminate this. Whereas with measles, you probably need to vaccinate a little more than 90% of the population to stop spread. Here, I think it's probably going to be closer to 70%. So I do think we can do that. I would be surprised if by next Thanksgiving, we weren't able to vaccinate 70% of the population. I think we will have enough vaccine. I think there's enough people who want to get it. So I think we're good. In terms of, you're absolutely right. This is not the last we're going to see of this. First of all, SARS, you know, CoV-1 raised its head in 2002. MERS came around about 10 years later. Both of those were novel coronaviruses. This is now the third novel coronavirus in less than 20 years. I think it's fair to say that we're going to see more of these kinds of viruses in the future. Hopefully we've learned our lesson this time. Hopefully we've learned our lesson that we need to prepare for these pandemics so that we can respond much better than we have here.
Yes. Well, thank you for that, Greg. Really important question. And we're planning to do a number of shows about what we know about this virus, where it came from. And then, as you said, what can be done to try to prevent similar viruses in the future. Thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller, Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the doctor about the possibility that there might be a silver lining to this very dark cloud in the form of we've finally proved the concept of mRNA as a viable vaccine. And I'm wondering about its extensibility to standard cancers, as the mechanism for immunotherapy treatment of cancers.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Phil. Yes, I think certainly this has been surprising. I don't think anybody would have predicted this level of protection and protection against severe disease and protection in older people. No one predicted that. And Dr. Fauci, I thought, was the most optimistic, and this was still well below his prediction. So people are now moving forward trying to answer the question, can this novel strategy, this mRNA strategy, work to make a human immunodeficiency virus vaccine? Can it work to make a better tuberculosis vaccine? Because the one we have certainly has weaknesses. Can it work to make a universal flu vaccine, et cetera? So that's one of it. And two, you're right. I mean, there already are studies ongoing looking at mRNA as a possibility to get you to make antibodies or T cell responses against tumor antigens, you know, that sit on the surface of tumor cells that will then make you better able to eliminate those tumor cells. So, yes, that's all ongoing. That's a great point.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Phil. We have another very important question from Fran, who writes, as a senior, I'm 87 with a pre-existing pulmonary condition, not in a nursing home, but living on my own. I am anxious to be immunized. My problem is I don't know how to identify myself to those who decide who gets the vaccine when it's my turn. What is the plan for seniors not in nursing homes?
Right. So technically, someone, as my mother falls in this category, someone who's over 65, not living or working in a long-term care facility, would be in the third tier. So technically, you know, it's sort of about 24 million people in the first tier, meaning liver work in long-term care facilities or essential healthcare workers. Second tier is other essential workers, you know, like people who work in transportation or utilities or education, et cetera. That's like another 85 million people. So you're probably talking about 100 million people would need to be vaccinated before they get to you. Now Dr. Fauci and Dr. Slowey from Warp Speed, he has predicted that he thought we could have 100 million people immunized by March. So it is possible that in the next few months, your number would come up to get a vaccine.
And are people going to get the vaccines through different, obviously different means, like a pharmacy or their hospital health provider?
Yeah, that's going to be the challenge. I think we're going to learn a lot over the next 6 months or so, and I'm sure there's going to be some stumbling around. I work with Dr. Rachel Levine, who's the head of who's the Secretary of Health in our Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And, you know, she the challenge is not so much Pittsburgh and Philadelphia in our state, because, you know, you have the kinds of facilities that can easily handle a vaccine like Pfizer's, which requires, dry ice for shipment and storage. And, you know, it has to constantly be maintained on dry ice. But when you get to these sparse rural areas where there may not even be a retail pharmacy nearby, you know, how to do it then? And there she's thinking of just sort of setting up places, essentially like drive-through places, in the same way, say, you would have a drive-through testing center. It's going to be a challenge, all of this, but we'll get it done.
Yeah, thank you, Francis. We will keep your question on our list, and we'll definitely do a show about this in the new year. Thank you for writing. We have another question from a listener who says, we hear about shortfalls in the vaccines, but very little about the second shot. What if people can't get the second shot within the recommended time frame, which is 3 weeks or much later than that time frame, or don't get the second shot at all? Can the first shot be effective, or would it be wasted without the second shot?
So from the Pfizer data, there were data that suggested that you look at people who got vaccine or got placebo between dose one and two. It did look like there was about 50% efficacy, but everybody got dose two. So you didn't really know how long that efficacy lasted. In answer to your question, what if you can't get back 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later? It doesn't matter. I mean, the point is to just get the second shot as soon as you can. You never need to start the series all over again.
Well, thank you for that question. You know, Fran wrote us back and said, my question is not what tier I'm in, but how to be sure I'm included in that tier. And I'm just thinking, all of the people on Medicare, you know, is Medicare going to be sending out notices to people to say, okay, it's time for you to get your vaccine, you're in line? I mean, this is, Dr. Offit, just a massive undertaking, because we're talking about millions and millions of people here.
No, if you look at people over 65, that's about 53 million people. That is the third tier. And you're right. The Medicare is certainly one way to do it. Not everybody over 65 is already linked into Medicare. But yeah, we're going to have to find a way to do that. But you can, I think the caller can be reassured that she is in the third tier. She's over 65. And so she should be able to get the vaccine, I would think, by March or April.
All right. Well, Fran, we'll keep you in mind, and be sure to keep your question in mind when we do shows about the vaccine in January. Dr. Offit, we talked about just the fact that since the United States does not have a national healthcare system, it's going to present a lot more challenges compared to countries who do have national healthcare systems. How are we going to keep track of people who have been vaccinated, especially if they need a second dose?
No, it's a good point. The retail pharmacies are actually pretty good at this. I mean, I think if my phone is any indication of how frequently they let you know that your prescription is ready, I think they're going to be pretty good about letting you know that you're ready for your second dose. I think that they can be a record keeping system. And then we just have to make sure that they link into what is, you know, your other healthcare system. But you're right, it's fragmented. I mean, this is the downside of not having a national health plan. It'll be interesting to see the way we roll out the Pfizer vaccine here as compared to the way the United Kingdom rolls it out, mm-hmm. where there is a national health plan. So my sister lives in the United Kingdom, so I've been hearing about this already.
Oh, interesting. Any major differences stand out for you?
No, it's just so much more efficient, you know, when you have sort of a federal system.
Right.
We'll see. We'll stumble around. We'll get it right, hopefully, eventually.
Right. And of course, people don't have to worry about coverage. I mean, that's the other question. Are all of these vaccines going to be free?
Yes, they're free. The issue is going to be covering for administration, whether there's going to be an administration fee associated with this, in which case, you know, does your insurance company cover that or not? But the vaccine itself is free. The government paid for this vaccine. Or said another way, your healthcare dollars paid for this vaccine.
What about monitoring symptoms or any issues people have? I mean, if you have a close relationship with your doctor, obviously you can express concerns to your doctor, but what if you don't go to the doctor very often? And I mean, a lot of people in this country don't, because they don't have health insurance or good health insurance. What if they get the vaccine at a Walgreens and then they have problems?
Yeah, and the vaccine, especially the second dose, especially for people who are less than 65, does have pretty significant side effect problems. It does. I think we can't understate this, and we have to let people know that that could happen, where they could have, you know, pretty significant fatigue, headache, muscle ache, chills, joint pain, et cetera. People need to know that. And then, you know, the hard part then comes in distinguishing that from another illness. But the good news is that this, when it occurs within 1 day or 2 days of this, and really is over usually within a day or two. So it is pretty evidently associated with the vaccine, and it gets better. So hopefully people will have that as a marker for what to think about.
Yeah, we need major PSAs, public service announcements. Two more questions before we let you go. What would you say to young people? Now, again, you've got young people who are being very responsible, and then you have young people who are not wearing masks, gathering in groups, you know, on and on.
Yeah, well, so otherwise healthy young people will be in the general population, and we should be getting to them sort of by no later than the summer. The if you look at sort of people who are less than 21 years of age in the United States, they make up about 26% of the population, but only 0.08% of the deaths. Obviously, the where deaths occur is in nursing homes. They make up 40% of the deaths. That said, as many people died of flu last year as died of COVID, SARS-CoV-2. So it's not, which is say around 140, 150 people. So you can die. You can be a healthy young person and still die from this virus. Mm-hmm. And two, and the most heinous part of this virus is it actually induces your immune response to destroy the cells that line blood vessels and cause a vasculitis, which can cause strokes, heart attacks, liver disease, kidney disease. I mean, we've seen kids in our hospital who have heart problems associated with this virus. That's the scariest part. This is not flu. I mean, flu usually causes a pneumonia, you know, kills you or doesn't. This virus can have longer term effects because it can actually destroy your blood vessels at some level. So people should be scared of this virus, including otherwise healthy young people.
Right. And last question from Bill. Will those who receive the initial vaccine injection and the booster shot receive some official form of unique proof of immunity to show to airlines, public officials, medical professionals, etc.? Dr. Offit, I was thinking about what it's going to be like to go back to live events, for example. Will venues say you can't come into this event unless you show us proof of a vaccine, for example?
Right. Yeah, that would be a nightmarish situation. First of all, not all vaccines are 100% effective, including this one. So you could show your proof of getting a vaccine and still be, if you look at the most recent data, that 1 in 20 group who's not protected. I mean, so 95% means 1 out of every 20 people who got this vaccine will not be protected against disease. So that kind of proof is really a little nonsensical. But no, I don't think that's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is over time, the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, the number of deaths will decrease and decrease and decrease. The percentage of people who are getting tested, you'll see that percentage that are found to be positive is lower and lower and lower. And then we'll get to the point where we're comfortable with a certain amount of disease and death, which is basically true with flu every year. I mean, flu last year caused 400,000 hospitalizations and 20,000 deaths. The year before was 700,000 hospitalizations and 60,000 deaths. If we wore a mask and social distance every winter, we would dramatically decrease those numbers, but we don't. We say we can live with this.
Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit co-invented the rotavirus vaccine and is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. Dr. Offit, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back in January.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we are going to talk about vaccine equity in poor countries, which could be forced to wait until at least 2022 for the virus because wealthy countries are hoarding so much of the supply. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about vaccine equity around the globe. Joining us is Dr. Moga Kamal-Yenne, policy advisor to the People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition of organizations and health leaders calling for a free and accessible COVID vaccine. Dr. Kamal-Yenne is also a policy advisor to UNAIDS, the UN Joint Program on HIV and AIDS. She's worked for decades on access to medicines and healthcare in developing countries, and she's based in the UK. Hi, Dr. Kamal-Yenne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to be on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us. You all just came out with a report that found 9 out of 10 people in 67 poor countries, including Kenya, Pakistan, and Myanmar, could be forced to wait until at least 2022 because wealthy countries are hoarding far more doses than they need. Can you tell us more about this report and how you came up with at least 2022?
Well, we have looked at all the figures of the deals that rich countries have made and the deals that poor countries have made, put them all in a big database and figured out the numbers and the time, basically. It all depends on what the companies and the countries announced. We got the data from there. And that showed quite clearly that rich countries have enough vaccines to vaccinate their people several times over, while poor countries don't have that luxury. In fact, they don't have the luxury of vaccinating the 20% of the population that the World Health Organization said are the estimated people at risk that should be vaccinated first.
You all report that so far all of Moderna's doses and 96% of Pfizer's doses have been acquired by wealthy countries?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. Most of the Moderna doses are acquired by the U.S. particularly, but also a few other rich countries like Europeans, Canada, and 5 million doses in the U.K. Pfizer, also the majority of their doses have been already secured for these countries. The same was with everybody. All the other companies have secured doses for rich countries. They already made these bilateral deals.
You also point out that the Oxford AstraZeneca company has pledged to provide 64% of their doses to people in developing nations. Yet despite their actions to scale up supply, they can still only reach 18% of the world's population next year at most.
Well, basically, when Oxford invented the vaccine and in their agreement in their contract with AstraZeneca, they were insisting on access to medicines and in making the vaccine available in developing countries at cost price during the pandemic. So they committed to, so AstraZeneca committed 300 million doses to the global mechanism for buying vaccines, something called COVAX, but also they did an agreement with the biggest vaccine manufacturer in India, Serum Institute, and Serum will produce 1 billion vaccine dose next year for developing countries, and they will sell it at $3 a dose. So that's why AstraZeneca has put more doses, if you like, than the other companies. However, you know, that means we're only relying on one company. And also, even with all these doses, all the agreement that AstraZeneca has made with India, and there's another agreement in Brazil and Argentina, even with these agreements, it still can't cover it. Because simply, there's not one company that can produce enough vaccines for all the world, or even for 20% of the world. Mm-hmm. So that there is an answer, though it shouldn't be like that. And it shouldn't be whether you vaccinate people in America or people in Kenya. It shouldn't be like that. There is a way of producing enough vaccines for all the people who need it.
So talk about what goes on behind the scenes and what changes would you like to see to ensure that a nurse in San Francisco is getting the vaccine at the same time as a nurse in Myanmar, for example.
So basically, the World Health Organization with Costa Rica, they launched a mechanism called CTAP, the Technology Access Pool. And the idea is that what's happening now is people are fighting, or countries rather, are fighting for a big share of if you have a small pizza, a very, very small pizza, and people are fighting for it. So the big guys will have the big share, and then crumbs will be left for the poor guys. Mm. And that's exactly what's happening now. So the idea is that We don't fight for the same pizza. We want the two nurses to have the vaccine at the same time. So what about enlarging the pizza so everybody can have a fair share of that pizza, so at the same time? So enlarging it means that we have more producers, whether this producer in developing countries or in anywhere. And having more producers, people cannot produce this. These companies in developing countries and in other countries cannot produce unless two things happen, that there is no intellectual property rights on the vaccines, and that the know-how and the technology is shared. So the World Health Organization created this pool where companies and universities that hold intellectual property also, or hold technology knowledge, they contribute what they have in that pool, and then the pool would license the intellectual property and the technology to the companies that can produce quality vaccines. And therefore, these other companies will produce more vaccines, more doses. And then globally, we will have more doses available for people. So you start vaccinating people everywhere at the same time. But companies are not doing that because they want to maintain the monopoly. They want to be the decision makers on what vaccines to produce, the number of doses, the supply, and the price.
The report points out that 5 of the 67 countries that might not have access to a vaccine until 2022, Kenya, Myanmar, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Ukraine, have reportedly nearly 1.5 million cases between them. Heidi Chow from the Global Justice Now said, governments must ensure the pharmaceutical industry puts people's lives before profits. So what can governments do about this?
Well, the thing is, the governments, I mean, let's not forget, normally governments fund basic research and quite a lot of the research cost. For COVID, they covered loads of the research and development and manufacturing at risk. So a lot, billions of dollars went into this. So basically carrying the whole risk of failure, it was carried by basically the taxpayer. And therefore, the governments, in making the bilateral deals, why can't they tell the companies, we'll give you all that money, and what we want from you is to share the technology in the pool. Mm-hmm. Why can't they do that? So that's one thing they can do. The other thing is that this week, and actually for a few months, there's been a discussion at the World Trade Organization about an idea from a proposal from India and South Africa, where they said, can we waive intellectual property, specific intellectual property, not the whole lot? So things like patent, for example. Can we waive these on COVID-related technologies during the pandemic until everybody is vaccinated and the pandemic is not a problem anymore? So we just waive it for this for a time period on particular products. Unfortunately, all rich countries stood against it. So it's still being discussed, but there's no decision because, all rich countries, as I say, refuse to do the waiver. So governments can agree on the waiver, really push pharmaceutical companies to join contribute to the pool. And stop this hoarding, because the thing is, from a purely selfish interest, by vaccinating a population of say in our country, you're not actually safe because your economy can't come back, because who are you going to trade with? Everybody else is sick, or everybody else is not vaccinated, and mm-hmm. It's only your country that's vaccinating. You're not going to trade just between America and Europe, are you? I mean, there's the rest of the world there. The supply chain will be, it would be as it is now, very delayed. Delays are causing problems in our countries. Delays on all sorts of things are causing problems. We can't have tourism, we can't trade. So economically, we can't return our economy to normal unless everybody else is okay outside our borders. And the other thing is, from a public health ground, we will continue to fight the vaccine. We'll continue to fight the virus until everybody else is vaccinated, so that the whole world is safe. So this saying that nobody's safe until everybody is safe is absolutely correct. It's a practical issue. Mm.
Dr. Kamal Yeneh, we're almost out of time, but we have a comment from a listener, Bill, who says, is this proposed unequal distribution of future vaccines an outcome of the capitalist economic system? Follow the money.
Well, okay, follow the money. The money is our money as people, because it's our tax. And therefore, it's, we have the right to say we want total transparency on the cost of the research, and total transparency on the price. And we want to share the vaccine because it is in our, share the knowledge and the intellectual property to produce more vaccines, because it's in our interest to actually have everybody vaccinated.
And Eid wants to point out, we don't have time to take your call, Eid, but Eid says it's important to point out that the head of Pfizer and Moderna are both immigrants.
Well, yeah. And, the inventors of the Pfizer vaccine, the inventors of the technology mRNA, are two Americans. One of them is from Hungarian origin. Some of the other company that actually developed the vaccine is a German company that was set up by two Turkish immigrants. So Turkish, American, German, Hungarian. You know, knowledge and science has no borders. And therefore, technology shouldn't have borders.
30 seconds, Dr. Kamal Yeneh. What's next for the People's Vaccine Alliance, and how can people get involved in the campaign?
Well, we continue to push for the sharing of knowledge and technology and intellectual property. We're developing our website so people can go there and support that call, support for an affordable vaccine, free at the point of use everywhere. So nobody should pay for it. And it should be according to need rather than ability to pay, or, you know, being born where you're born, basically. That shouldn't decide where you get it.
Dr. Moga Kamal Yeneh is policy advisor to the People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition of organization and health leaders calling for a free and accessible COVID vaccine around the globe. Dr. Kamal Yeneh, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You can find more information about the People's Vaccine Alliance at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.